From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good evening and welcome to this Monday edition of Washington Watch. My name is Joseph Backholm and I'm sitting in for Tony with you today. My pleasure to be with you as we get the week going. Before we get into the program, I want to remind you about a special event and a special opportunity. We are calling believers to commit to praying for and standing with Israel, and for Bible-believing churches to do so collectively on Sunday, May 19th, by dedicating a portion of their worship services to pray for Israel's peace, prosperity, and protection. To learn more about this important effort and to sign the pledge, visit prayandstand.com or text the word Israel to 67742. That's Israel, I-S-R-A-E-L, to 67742. Today on the program, college campuses erupted over the weekend with pro-Palestinian protests that are becoming explicitly anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. So much so that Jewish students are being warned to stay home. Are college campuses doing enough to keep students safe? We'll discuss that today. Also, the Republican National Committee has announced plans to organize 100,000 election integrity workers in battleground states. What will they be doing? And can it guarantee the accuracy of this November's election? Also, England's National Health Service released the findings of a four-year study commissioned to review the gender services provided for children and young people. That study has provided further support for their decision not to surgically or chemically disguise the sex of minors as a way of treating mental health. Is anyone in the U.S. interested in following the science? We'll discuss that as well. But now for our headlines today. Over the weekend, the House of Representatives passed a $95 billion foreign aid package that includes aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. This legislation now heads to the Senate, where it is expected to pass this week. These spending bills exposed division among the House Republican Conference, particularly regarding additional spending for Ukraine, which received an additional $61 billion in this round of aid spending. Joining me now to discuss it is Congressman Glenn Grothman. He represents the 6th Congressional District in Wisconsin. Congressman Grothman, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, glad to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. It was an eventful Saturday in the Capitol building. Tell us what happened from your perspective.
Well, we had three bills, which were all spending bills. The frustrating thing is, I think the thing of most concern that's happened in this country about the last 80 years is this overwhelming group of people coming across our southern border. It's something that we have to get the Biden administration to address. Only they can address it. And this was the final opportunity to force the Biden administration to come to the table and reduce the number of people streaming there. And the Republicans decided not to take advantage of the situation. Part of it could have been there were a given number of Republicans who just plain felt Ukraine was way more important than what was going on the southern border, and they forced Speaker Johnson's hand. But either way, something has to be done. To remind your listeners, we have, depending on the month, between 220 and 350,000 people crossing our southern border, something we've never seen before. It's got to be addressed. It could have been addressed by holding up the Ukraine bill. It could have been addressed by holding up, I guess what I'll refer to as a budget or appropriation bill a few weeks ago. It has not been addressed. And now I think we're largely helpless until hopefully we get a new president sworn in January. And by that time, you're going to have another, 3 or 4 million people coming across the border.
Yeah. Well, there were separate aid packages discussed and debated on over the weekend. You voted in support of aid for Taiwan and Israel, but against further aid for Ukraine. Why do you see those situations differently?
Well, it was a smaller bill with regard to Southeast Asia. I did not like to vote yes for that, but I think China at all times is considering, will we or won't we invade Taiwan? I think to vote no there, some Republicans voted no, but to get a big no vote there is kind of sending the message to China that Taiwan is not as important. Taiwan is very important to this country. And the easiest way to make sure China does not invade Taiwan is to make sure the United States is ready. With regard to Israel, there was some money in there that I wouldn't like to have seen in there, but Israel has been a long ally of the United States in that part of the region. They're going to have a lot more fighting to do. We talk about what happened to Iran in the recent past, the huge number of missiles shot in there. But one thing a lot of Americans are not aware of is that there are, I believe, about 80,000 Israelis who can't go home every night because of rockets being shot in by Hezbollah out of Lebanon. Right. And obviously, Israel cannot permanently tell 70 or 80,000 of their citizens you can't go home at night. So that's something that has to be done. With regard to Ukraine, we do not want Ukraine to fall, but to me, we have two big problems there. First of all, the Biden administration, over 2 years into this thing, has not done anything to try to, from what I can see, to try to end this war. All wars end. Okay, the Korean War ended, and President Eisenhower even had to negotiate with the communist Chinese, maybe the greatest mass murdering dictatorship in history. But he still dealt with them. We have had peace, largely peace, on the Korean Peninsula now for about 70 years. This idea of we are not going to try to wrap up the Ukrainian war is a big mistake. It's a big mistake for the United States. What we're doing is, as it drags on, as we try not to get a peace, it drives Russia, China, and Iran together. I don't think we want this group of nations to be all that much stronger to drag on this war. I think it questionably makes Iran's military more powerful, probably makes China more powerful, things we don't like to see. So I voted no on that because, like I said, there's no effort to wrap things up. And it's the final chance until the new president is sworn in to try to force President Biden to drop that number, 300, 250,000 people coming across the southern border. By the way, I just got to talking to somebody who has relatives down in the Tucson area. Their house has been broken in down there, and they believe it's by illegal immigrants. They're facing criminal problems they never had until now. But if you're going to keep taking that many people across the border, you're going to continue to have that problem.
We're speaking with Congressman Glenn Grothman from Wisconsin. And Congressman, you mentioned there the connection that has been made, at least politically, between our own border security and the Ukrainian border security, if we can put it that way. And you wished to see that issue leveraged, the support of Ukraine and the desire to support Ukraine, to also secure the southern border. So is this more an opportunity, and maybe you can speak for yourself and other Republican colleagues who share your position and voted against the aid package, is the primary concern that we should wait and make sure we do both, or is there concern about the aid to Ukraine just on the merits?
Both. Like I said, on the merits, one more time, we're giving the Biden administration more money without him looking for a peace. I'd like to remind your listeners that Ukraine has the second lowest birth rate in the world, below only South Korea, and Russia also has a huge shortage of young people. I mean, if there are two countries who should not want to lose any more young people in a war, it's Russia and Ukraine. So that's the first problem. The second problem is it's the final chance, and quite frankly, a chance we were assured we would take, as Republican leadership assured they would do it. It's our final chance to force the Biden administration into doing something at the border. I think the Biden administration may have done something. There was a rather weak proposal put out by Senator Lankford of Oklahoma, but the Biden administration sometimes touts that. So it's an indication the Biden administration would do something. Yeah. I think the fact that we got nothing here was just a huge wasted opportunity. And I think, quite frankly, more questions ought to be asked across the board among Republican leadership. Why didn't you start with the Lankford package and go from there? Why are we just agreeing, in essence, to be helpless for the next 8 months until a new president is sworn in, 9 months?
Well, I think there is plenty of evidence that the Biden administration is sensitive to the immigration and border security issue as they head into November, because voters are very concerned about it. Therefore, they must be concerned about it, and they want to at least pretend to be caring. But I'd also like to get your comments on the politics of how this vote might affect what's going on in the Republican caucus. We know there is a one vote Republican majority right now in the House, as narrow as it could be. There is a motion to vacate that has been introduced in the House with respect to Speaker Johnson. Do you see this vote impacting that at all? No. Any chance that moves forward?
No. We have three Republicans who have stepped forward and said they want to get rid of Speaker Johnson. I believe the Democrat Party will provide some votes to keep them here. The idea of trying to train a new person with elections only 7 months away is on the face of it foolish. You know, you just can't pick a random congressman out and say, we're going to make him speaker. It takes a long time to prepare for that. I have watched Mike Johnson learn more and become a better speaker over the 6 or 7 months that he's been in there. I have no desire to begin to train a new person. A lot of the people who run for that job have even less experience than Mike. My personal opinion is to be speaker, you ought to have at least 15 or 16 years experience. Mike does not have that amount, but he does have 7 or 8 years experience now. So the idea that we try to train another person 8 or 9 months before election is just madness.
Well, that has to be one of the hardest jobs in the world at this point, running
no question, the
House of Representatives.
Mike is learning, and he's getting better all the time. Like I said, I wish he would have leveraged one of these bills to get something going at the border, but this was his position, and obviously a majority of Republicans, a clear majority, not me, but a clear majority of Republicans felt that they could go ahead and vote for a lot more money for Ukraine before getting any guarantees at the border.
Congressman Grothman, a related but slightly different subject. Over the weekend, there were a lot of protests that were genuinely pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel, anti-Jewish over the weekend on college campuses. We know that the conflict in Israel is becoming a conflict in the U.S. in many ways. So far, not that violent, at least. What's your reaction to what's happening on college campuses?
I think it's coming from three areas. One is, just because it's on a college campus doesn't mean it's a college student. I was told that my own alma mater, University of Wisconsin, apparently some of the demonstrators there are just kind of old left-wing hangers-on who aren't connected with the university. But I think otherwise they're from two areas. I think as we see more immigration from that part of the world, we're going to find that we have new migrants who are not sympathetic to Israel, are much more sympathetic to the Arab part of the world there. That's something that's going to happen if we have open borders or just continue to allow unlimited immigration in this country. The second problem is, I think all successful westernized nations face a problem in that, I'll call them, they're spoiled. The spoiled children of the upper middle class like to demonstrate against America or demonstrate against the West. And of course, what's going on in Israel, you have a...
Congressman, we got about 10 seconds. Keep going.
Okay. You have the spoiled kids of the upper middle class who don't like the West. And when it's in Israel, that means they don't like Israel, which is a shame, but that's what's going on.
Congressman Grothman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
On the other side of the break, we're going to continue this conversation about what's going on campuses with Rabbi Yaakov Menken from the Coalition for Jewish Values. Stay with us.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Violence erupted at anti-Israel demonstrations on multiple college campuses over the weekend, including at Yale University, where a Jewish student was stabbed in the eye with a Palestinian flag. In a statement that condemned both the anti-Semitic language and the intimidating and harassing behavior of many students, the president of Columbia University announced last night that classes would be held online only today for safety reasons. Are colleges doing enough to protect Jewish students? How can Christians help this effort? Joining me now to discuss it is Rabbi Yaakov Menken, Managing Director of the Coalition for Jewish Values. Rabbi Menken, welcome to Washington Watch and happy Passover.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
It's good to be with you. Your reaction when you saw the anti-Semitism at these demonstrations last weekend?
Well, are they doing enough? The answer is obviously a resounding no. Very sadly, obviously, humanity has seen this happen before. Anti-Semitism is always about finding a facade, a pretense, and then moving on to their end goal, which has always been ethnic cleansing and genocide. And that is exactly what we're seeing happen. The fact of the matter is that to claim that oh, it's just about anti-Israel. Like you said, it's the anti-Israel protests, but they were never anti-Israel protests. They were always anti-Semitic protests that glorify terrorism, that glorify atrocities, actual beheading of babies and rapes and holding hostages. These are not decent human beings. Columbia was confronted with a clear choice, either the anti-Semitic barbarians or the Jews. They expressly chose the anti-Semitic barbarians. Bottom line, the reason why classes went virtual at Columbia today is because the rabbi of the OUJLIC at that campus said to the Jewish students, "It's not safe for you here. I suggest you return home as soon as possible until the situation on campus changes." Let's be clear. Jews are being ethnically cleansed from Columbia University for their own safety. And there was one professor, Shai Davidai, who was having none of it. He said, I am bringing 10 students and alumni with me Monday morning. We're going to go onto the campus. We're going to go right into the middle of that anti-Semitic demonstration, and we insist you keep us safe. Columbia deactivated the access card of their professor, Shai Davidai. Professor Shai Davidai of Columbia University had his access card deactivated by the university to prevent him from interfering with the anti-Semitic pro-Hamas demonstration at that campus. The entire administration of Columbia is utterly compromised by Jew hatred. This is exactly how the Nazis took over. And we're watching it happen at Columbia. We're watching it happen at Yale and Harvard and Penn, MIT, Princeton. It's obviously the most elite places, because that's the places where they have to compete with Jews.
Now, Rabbi, you identify the problem at these elite universities. Is this a bottom-up movement, or is this a top-down movement? Because we're focused on the protesters on these campuses, and we assume that these are students, though I think there's evidence to suggest they're not all students. It's just people on the campus in some cases. But is this something that has surprised the administration of these universities, and they just genuinely don't know how to handle this? Or is this in some way a product of the administrators of these universities?
It is clearly a mixture that happened over time. There's a certain bottom-up wag the dog. We have a statement in our Talmud that says that as we reach the end days, that the face of the generation will be the face of a dog. And one of the explanations of that is, look at a dog on the end of its leash, a person who'd never seen a dog and a human master before, the owner of that dog, might imagine the dog is leading the master, right? But then the master takes a right turn at the corner. The dog continues on for a moment, realizes master's gone and off in a new direction, and a second later, the dog is leading in the new direction. Sadly, a democracy leads to that sort of thing, where people just kind of follow by holding, you know, they determine their positions by holding up their finger into the wind. That's what seems to have happened to a certain extent. But to another extent, these are the left-wing protesters, anti-establishment, which means to say anti-decency, anti-foundational values. These folks who were students with their, you know, the long haircuts and the bandanas are now professors, tenured right. professors, in some cases even deans of students. So at a certain point, they take over, you know, top down. Like I said, Columbia administration has clearly chosen the anti-Semitic barbarians over the Jews. And you can't say that that's just, oh, you know, they didn't think about it or they didn't know what to do. They had to choose to deactivate the access card of a Jewish professor. Yeah.
Rabbi, we have about a minute left for this one, but how would you describe the kind of metamorphosis on the left from into becoming a fairly anti-Israel and increasingly anti-Jewish political movement, that seems to be part of their identity?
Well, it's all about that hatred for values that I've talked about. I've talked about it with Tony on this show, that you look at around the world at the countries where Christians are experiencing the worst persecution, and these are countries that already have no Jews. You know, places like Iraq, Syria, they get rid of the Jews, then they turn on the Christians. Egypt, same story. So you're watching this happen on campus. These so-called Palestinian protesters who are supposed to be about politics, or maybe they just want to target Jews. Well, why are they disturbing Christmas tree lightings and the Easter vigil in St. Patrick's Cathedral? They're not interested just in Jews, much less Israel. They're interested in attacking America, its core values, and the values of the founding fathers that they got in the Bible.
In about 15 seconds, what can Christians do to support the Jewish community?
Well, first thing is, you've got to realize this is your problem. It is not a Jewish problem. In fact, we're going to read in the Passover Seder tonight, we're going to read that in every generation, they rise up to destroy us and God saves us from their hands. There is a divine promise of Jewish survival. There is no divine promise of American survival. Americans need to fight back against this. You need to pull your dollars from Colombia for sure. I mean, it's just obvious. We love what Congress is doing in the House under Virginia Fox.
I've got to cut you off there. I love the defunding piece, but we are out of time. Thank you for being with us, Rabbi Menken.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next, the Republican National Committee is planning 100,000 election integrity team members. What are they going to do, and is it going to help? We'll be back.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leela Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. On Friday, the Republican National Committee and the Trump presidential campaign announced their plan to organize more than 100,000 election integrity volunteers and lawyers in battleground states during the upcoming 2024 presidential election. The plan includes placing representatives both at voting sites as well as the ballot counting centers, along with an election integrity hotline for lawyers to field questions from those monitoring the on-site locations. Joining me now to discuss this is Christina Bobb. She's the Senior Counsel for Election Integrity at the Republican National Committee. Christina, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
Where do you see the most significant threats to conducting an election in 2024 that the public can have confidence in?
Well, I think mail-in ballots certainly are a big concern as far as the chain of custody and keeping track of them. So the biggest concern is just making sure that people on the ground, people in these communities are involved, paying attention, make sure you know what's going on in your counties. And I think if we have enough people with eyes on and part of the process, we can have a secure election.
And I want to talk specifically about what these 100,000 election integrity workers, and that's an ambitious goal, across the U.S. will be doing, because you mentioned there specifically the chain of custody concerns associated with mail-in ballots. How will these volunteers help ensure that the mail-in ballot process is trustworthy?
Well, it's being part of the process, right? It's being on the ground in these counties. And there's a number of things that these volunteers and workers can do before the election and then things that need to occur during the election. There's a lot of really great grassroots currently working to contact county officials and ask them, you know, what are you doing to secure them? Let the county officials know that you're paying attention and you want to hold them accountable to make sure that they're following the law and just checking in on that. And then, of course, here at the RNC, making sure that we're training workers, training people to understand what the law is, what they can and can't do, being part of that process as far as watching when the ballots come in, where there's allowed to be observers, when they come in and they can see the actual chain of custody tragedy and the process all the way through, it's really important to have people with eyes on who can report problems as they arise so we can deal with it then and not have to deal with it after the fact.
Do you expect that there will also be Democrat volunteers and lawyers essentially performing the same role on their side?
I hope so. I certainly hope both sides want election integrity. From 2020, we saw that there certainly was no shortage of Democrats that had opinions and had positions on the way things needed to be conducted in 2020. The concern for us was that Republicans were largely excluded. We saw Republicans kicked out. We saw pizza boxes and cardboard boxes being put up on the windows so people couldn't see into what was going on. Recently, we had to file 2 complaints with the Wisconsin Election Commission due to Madison and Milwaukee not hiring enough Republican workers, even though the Republican Party had submitted more than 250 names of people who had confirmed that they were willing to work the election, and they called less than 50 of them in order to actually be part of the process. So, yes, I think there will be Democrats, and we need them. We need representation from both sides. But the problem that we have seen is that they've been excluding Republicans in a lot of these key places.
A lot of the ballot counting happens at the local level in county offices generally. Do you perceive general openness to this kind of the level of transparency that you're looking for and accountability and kind of oversight? Or are the people doing the ballot counting kind of hostile to what you're proposing?
Well, hopefully this time around they will not be hostile, although we certainly saw some of that in 2020. There was a lot of disputes about what was going on because we could not see into what was taking place. So I am happy with the precinct counting, where we see the counties that count at the precinct level. That in and of itself is a form of election security because it's decentralized. You have all of the counting taking place at these various precincts, which when you have different precincts doing the counting, that is a level of security because it's decentralized. But when we see these big voting centers where everything is centralized counting, that's where it becomes a lot murkier and it's harder to see because you have a couple people doing counting in a back room that count for the entire county, and it's much easier to cheat when it's all centralized. So us good conservatives like to decentralize command and control in order to make sure that there are security measures in place. So it's these big centralized counting facilities like we saw in 2020 at the State Farm Arena in Fulton County and in Milwaukee and in Philadelphia, and in Detroit, the TCF Center, where we had the biggest concerns. So personally, my biggest concern, or where I'm kind of, you know, paying a little extra attention, is to the big centralized vote counting facilities that are centralized.
Christina, we've got about a minute left. There's been a lot of concern about election integrity on the right. Do you have a sense for how many voters have become disinclined to participate simply because they don't trust the process? And do you have reason to believe that this effort will enhance confidence in the process and therefore participation?
Well, I hope it does. It does that. I hope it enhances participation because we need everybody to vote. 2024 is a pivotal election, and we need everyone to vote. If you have concerns and are worried about it, the best thing you can do is to get involved in the process. I'm fortunate to work with people across the country, a lot of grassroots efforts. And I can tell you the people that are involved and engaged on the ground are not discouraged. They're very encouraged by the amount of enthusiasm and people involved that are concerned about this and working to protect their local election. So if you're one of these folks that say, oh, I don't know if I can trust my vote, I don't know if I should vote, get involved. You're exactly the kind of person that we need to get involved in the process to be part of the solution, and it will encourage you because courage is contagious, and these grassroots efforts have been fantastic, and I'm honored to work with
Christina,
the folks on the ground.
Very quickly, tell people how they can. Is there a website?
Please. Yep, please go to protectthevote.com, sign up. That's the RNC's website, protectthevote.com, and we'll get you plugged in.
Christina Bob, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
After the break, as the pillars beneath the transgender ideology crumble, will that affect what's happening in the U.S.?
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Lila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Don't forget to order Tony's new digital study guide called Joshua, Finish Strong. To download your copy today, please go online to frc.org/Joshua. Or text the word Joshua to 67742. For those of you who are following along in the Bible reading plan, and I hope that is all of you. Again, text the word Joshua to 67742. Earlier this month, England's National Health Service released the findings of a four-year study commissioned to review the gender services provided for children and young people. The final report, written by leading pediatrician Dr. Hilary Cass, made clear both the damage caused by these practices as well as a lack of evidence behind the recommendation of these procedures. English officials appear to recognize the significance of the Cass report and now prohibit most of these gender procedures on children. But many on the left have doubled down on their cause. Dr. Cass has been forced to avoid public transportation due to security concerns. And the activist group GLAAD continues to insist the science on this topic is settled in their direction, targeting journalists who accurately report the shaky foundation behind these practices. Now, will there be a breakthrough where mainstream organizations in the U.S. recognize the harm caused by these procedures? Joining me now to discuss it is Walt Heyer. He's a senior fellow at the Family Research Council and founder of SexChangeRegret.com. Walt, good to see you today.
Yeah, Joseph, thanks for having me on. It's a great topic, one of my favorite topics. So,
well, and there are a few people better to discuss it than you. And before we get into the Cass report, I want to give you a chance to share your story with those who may not be familiar briefly.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who struggled early on. In fact, Joseph, it was 79 years ago, I was a cross-dressing young boy in 1944. And the fact that my grandmother made me a purple chiffon dress and affirmed me in the dress, told me how cute I was and so forth, I can tell you that's child abuse. It's emotional and psychological child abuse. And that's a practice all of us need to stop. And it's harmed me. I wouldn't be talking about it at 83 years old about something that happened to me when I was four, unless it had a great deal of harm. And it caused my life 50 years of struggle with my identity. Yeah. And ended up going through the hormone procedures, went through the surgical procedures, ended up living, identifying as a female for 8 years as a result of my grandmother putting me in a purple chiffon dress and some other incidents that happened when I was young, including being sexually and physically abused.
Now, it seems, at least in England, their national health services have done some research that seems to support the experience that you've lived through, which is transitioning people chemically and surgically, especially children, does not actually relieve the mental distress that these so-called treatments are intended to fix, to solve. What's your reaction to that research?
Well, I know the research is correct because, as you mentioned, you know, I'm the founder of sexchangeregret.com, and that's been nearly 14 years ago. And the fact of the matter is that people have been writing me asking for help after they've taken hormones and had surgery, and all of them, 100% of them, report being harmed by the hormones and surgery. In fact, what we recognize today is, Joseph, is that hormones devalue a person, and the surgery destroys people. So we're just devaluing people and destroying them. And so people aren't—they don't change their gender. That's the other critical thing is that the hormones and surgery has never changed anybody's gender. We're dealing with an identity issue, and that something happened to these individuals early in life that caused them to not like who they are. And it's not even about gender.
Yeah. Well, despite the anger from some activists directed at Dr. Cass, this has actually led to change in the UK, which seems remarkable that the NHS has, as we like to say these days, followed the science, and they've actually changed their behavior. But on this side of the pond, we've seen resistance to that, and in many cases, LGBT activists who insist that chemical and surgical modifications as a treatment for what they refer to as gender dysphoria is still the right path. What's your reaction to that?
Well, obviously, it's not the right path. I mean, you know, England had a report back in 2004 out of the University of Birmingham that actually said many of the same things that the Cass report says. So we've known about the harm being done in England, reported it in their studies years ago. In fact, it even reported in that study, it was University of Birmingham reported that people are more likely to commit suicide after undergoing hormones and surgery. That was July 2004, was reported in the UK Guardian by David Batty. So the research is, it continues to destroy the idea that you can change your gender, that it's helpful. It's always been harmful. I mean, the first notice about the harm being done was in 1978 here in this country. And so Dr. Charles L. Ehlenfeld, who worked for 6 years at a gender clinic, the Benjamin Gender Clinic in New York, reported that hormones were causing too much harm and too many ended up committing suicide. That was in 1979. So these studies keep coming out. And here's my own life experience saying I attempted suicide within a few weeks after undergoing the procedure. And thanks to the good Lord redeeming my life, I'm here. But the fact of the matter is these stories, Joseph, continue to come out and they gain a little bit of traction and then they kind of get covered up again. So I think it's important for us to keep the pedal to the metal and keep pushing and telling the truth and like you're doing today and put these stories out about the harm being done, because it's all destroying lives. That's what it does. Yeah.
Well, with respect to that scenario you just described there, where they gain a little traction, then they get covered up again, the Cass report addressed that a bit, and they talked about the fear that many doctors have with discussing this topic. And here's a quote that I want to let you react to. He said, there are a few other areas of healthcare where professionals are so afraid to openly discuss their views, where people are vilified on social media, where name-calling echoes the worst bullying behavior. This must stop. End quote. Now, what's your reaction to their apparent acknowledgement that open, honest discussion about this topic is not tolerated in many quarters?
Well, I can tell you on a personal level, my own doctor, who is afraid to talk about, she knows my whole story. She knows from looking at my books and looking at other materials I have online. And she has actually prayed with me when I've been in there for guidance from her. And she said she can't talk about it. She can't tell anybody where she is because she's in a large medical institution. So yes, it's true. And here's another thing. Everybody has to sort of clam up about this, and we need more people to step up and keep pushing and pushing and being stronger about it. And we're gonna win the battle because the information's there, and we can crush these people who keep trying to redo and say that it's helpful.
Yeah. This issue does seem to be uniquely emotional, given the nature of what's happening. You are either providing permanent long-term help or you are creating permanent long-term harm. By the nature of these so-called treatments, you are doing something that is irreversible. And so to that point, recognizing that that's just true, whether you think it's helpful or not helpful, do you think this is an issue where the implications of being wrong are so horrible that some people will never be willing to admit that possibility, regardless of how much evidence there is? Therefore, we could have 100 Cass reports all reaching the same conclusions, and we're still going to deal with a passionate, motivated kind of parental group and medical group that is not willing to consider the possibility that they made mistakes because of what that would mean about their decisions and how that impacted children.
Well, absolutely, Joseph. I mean, consider where we are today. If people on the inside that have been doing these procedures and harming people, what would they do if they start admitting that they know the harm? In fact, you know, one of the Marcy Bowers, I even talked to Marcy Bowers through email one time about one of my clients, and she's not about to say anything. She's making $1,300,000 or $1.5 million a year doing these procedures. So the people are too invested financially and making these lies about the fact that it's helping people, and they really don't care about the consequences. And until such time as we see, like, what, 23 states now have banned it, mm-hmm. and until we see more lawsuits where medical malpractice cases affect the doctors in a negative way, I think that's probably going to be where the end comes. It's going to be through medical malpractice cases, because they're not going to admit it on their own, Joseph.
Well, and that was my follow-up question, because you have expressed some optimism long-term on this issue that eventually we will come to our senses and realize this is not helpful. You do think that that's not going to happen necessarily politically, but through the legal system, where lawyers are essentially going to come to the defense of these children, and that's going to shut it down?
I don't know about shutting it down. I think there's going to be, there's always going to be people out there doing this, you know, because it's just the way people are. But I do think that the medical malpractice is going to affect this in a negative way. I've even seen cases now where, you know, the medical malpractice fees, because of these states saying you can't do this to children anymore, their medical malpractice fees are going up so high, doctors won't do the procedures. So I think that's another side to this that is exposing how bad it is when the people are saying, you know, your medical malpractice thing might be $700,000 a year or whatever it is. I don't know. That's not an accurate number, but just as an example. Yeah. And the doctor said, I can't afford it, so I can't go into this practice.
Yeah. Well, we know your story and the Cass report clearly documents the fact that that's not unique. Still, we can find people today who would say, this saved my life. I absolutely needed that procedure, and without it, I would be dead in some way. What's your response to those people who are still, on a personal level, saying this was critical for me, therefore it should be available for others?
Yeah, Joseph, I've had people that have written me and they've said very horrible things, you know, take down your website, you know, because, you know, it really worked for me. And I've had them write me back 2, 3, 4 years later and say, Walt, I need your help. This was a mistake. So I think until we have 20 to 25 years of experience with each individual and see what their outcomes are, I think we're going to continue to see people are going to raise up and say, no, this isn't working. But even though there's people saying it does, all we need to do is wait a few years and we'll find out that it doesn't work. Because I've had them, Joseph, report to me 40 years after the surgical procedure and the hormones, say they wished they would have admitted that they were wrong 20 years before instead of suffering from an additional 20 years.
Well, the legislative efforts on this really have focused on children. And the idea has been that adults should be allowed to do what adults want to do. And if that includes mutilating your body or taking hormones, cross-sex hormones, you should be allowed to do that. Do you think that's the right approach politically, legislatively?
Personally, I don't think so. I wish there would have been some guardrails up there for me. You know, when you go in 1981, I go into a doctor who was one of the original chairpersons who wrote the standards of care, the WPATH standards of care, diagnosed me in 1981 with gender dysphoria. And I had told him my whole life story about the abuses and so forth that went on. And he says, well, you need hormones and surgery. Well, you know, I look back at that, and that is so insane. The fact of the matter is, Joseph, in every single individual that I personally worked with, sat down and spent time with in helping them, they admit that they never had gender dysphoria, that it was something else. They had adverse childhood experiences, or they suffered some deep depression because of their parents' divorce, or because they moved, or because they had an illness themselves, or their dad was incarcerated, or whatever. Their mom died in a plane crash. All these things are traumatizing to young people, and they're trying to treat trauma and early childhood abuse with hormones and surgery, which is like barbaric. This is Frankenstein stuff. This is absolutely insane. There isn't any child, for the purpose of changing genders, who needs hormones and surgery. They need good psychotherapy to deal with the underlying psychological issues that are causing them to not like who they are. Let's find out what they are and actually deal with those issues and prevent them from having hormones and surgery. And that will not harm them for the rest of their life. It will actually help them. So I think, you know, there's just too many people out there that are unwilling to step up and say, you know, this is harmful. And there's too many results. You've seen them. I've seen them. Yeah. The CAST report's got it, too.
In about 30 seconds, what's your advice to people who may be dealing with people in their family struggling with this question right now?
Yeah, I think we can all step back. And if we have somebody who's struggling with this, take a look at their early childhood, if they're drinking, if they have alcohol issues, if they're stuck on pornography, if they had a real difficult childhood. Let's talk about your childhood. Let's talk about your addiction. Let's talk about pornography. All of these things affect you in a negative way. And I know that this is the pathway to taking hormones and surgery as a way to try to kill the pain, because I did it, tried to kill the pain of early childhood addictions, trauma, and abuse.
Walt Heyer, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom.
You're welcome.
Friends, that's our program for today. Thank you for joining us here on Washington Watch. We will see you tomorrow on the program. Until then, fear God and nothing else.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.
Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.